in an intimate relationship. Women who are not Jewish can also call, and we can help them with resources. We also understand that men and people of all genders can experience abuse. But for the purpose of this presentation, and because 98% of our calls are from women, we will refer to the abuser as he. We are committed to not abandoning any of our clients and are flexible in order to speak with them. We are worried all the time about how to keep them safe. We have one staff in the office who makes all the appointments and does the intakes. There are 5 therapists, 2 on call per month. We communicate with clients using different cell phones, and we dial *67 so our number doesn't come up. All kinds of covert things to reach them. If a client can't get to the phone, we leave a cryptic message and set another time. We cannot FaceTime and we cannot Zoom, as it is not safe. And supervision and extra support is given to staff throughout the week. Our clients are remarkable. They are smart. They are resourceful and resilient women in varying circumstances. They are already in a state of alert and trauma, and now they're isolated. They are forced to choose between the danger at home and the danger outside. Some clients who have left their abuser and are living on their own but have lost a job are forced to move back in with their partner. Some are living alone or with their children. Some are going through the divorce process but are living in the same home, and you can imagine that would be the most dangerous time. Some have completely disengaged from what is going on around them because they're focused on basic needs: survival, food, shelter, and safety. Mental health and substance abuse issues, as well as stress or loss of income, can exacerbate domestic violence, but I want to be clear, that is not the cause. We know that any time an abuser may be feeling a loss of control, abusive behavior will escalate. Anything in their toolbox will be used to regain power. The coronavirus has become one of those tools. Our clients have reported these situations since March.
Sorry, Barbara, is it possible to raise your volume a little bit? A little. Or maybe just a little bit louder. Sorry.
How's it?
A little better.
Okay, I'm not saying anything. Is it better?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Get it. Have you not heard anything I've said? Okay. So our clients have reported since March. He has locked her out of the house because she has asthma and allergies, and he insists that she has the virus. He insists she go to the mikvah. Despite all the precautions they have taken, she's fearful. He has stolen the stimulus check, has refused to pay child support, refuses to return the children after having time with them, accusing her of having the virus. He expects her to come back to him because he will protect her. In fact, he's the only one. Safe environment, but takes no precautions when he comes home to her and the children. No one has seen her. He has told the rabbi and other people that she's sick and she is crazy. The effects on our clients are overwhelming. Their mind is in a fight or flight or freeze mode of perpetual worry that there will be an eruption at home in front of the children. And they are afraid to call the police or go to a hospital, especially if they have an autoimmune disease. They may be experiencing long hours of sitting alone with traumatic effects on children are tremendous. And now they are. They have no safety net, like school or outside areas, and they can't go to grandparents for fear of infecting them. They're acting out in confinement. The husband is criticizing and undermining her parenting.
Hi, Barbara. I'm so sorry to stop you again. We can't hear.
Okay. I don't know why. At all?
Very low.
Okay. Now, is that better?
That's better. If you speak very loud.
Okay. I'll speak loud.
Okay. Yeah. Better. I think it might be the microphone.
Okay. Okay. Well, I have a good microphone. Okay. Ready? So he's frightening the children by telling them to stay away from sick mommy. So what do we say to clients? The clinical staff are the voices of calm and reassurance that we are there for them. We are the cheerleaders. We do some regulating and grounding routines to help them manage their fear and their anxiety. We help them disengage from the abuser, and we focus on self-care. We suggest they turn off the 24-hour news cycle. We emphasize that structure and routine are helpful. We help with parenting issues and ways to communicate with their children. And when possible, we are able to provide help with food, rent, and legal advice. There are a few things that you can say if you are concerned about someone you care about and that they may not be in a safe relationship. Reach out, get in touch regularly. Use empowering, not judgment, language. Keep in mind that she's the expert in her own life. Help her safety plan, give her resources, and don't abandon her if she does nothing at all. If you go to our website, you will see a series of interactive tools with various scenarios of how to have these hard conversations. You can also refer her to our Orthodox Rabbinic Task Force, where there are 12 rabbis that have been trained, and she can speak to any one of them anonymously about any concerns that she might have. Most of all, we remind our clients, and I want to remind you as well. It's okay not to feel productive during these uncertain times. The open-endedness of this situation is extremely difficult. Feelings of sadness, loss of normalcy, and connection are not unusual. It's important to be gentle with yourself and believe that together, as a Jewish community, we will get through this.
Great. Thank you so much, Barbara.
Okay.
Next up, we have Dr. Leah Knapp, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, a noted teacher and lecturer, to address us on questions that come up in terms of Shalom Bayit during this time.
Okay, now that I've unmuted, can everybody hear me? Yes? Okay, wonderful. Before I begin, I want to take a moment to thank you, Emma, and the entire Neely for inviting me to join you in tonight's conversation. I also want to give a big socially distanced hug to all of you, the women of the community who've chosen to spend an evening with us, thinking and sharing ideas about the challenges that we are encountering during this pandemic and all that it includes. I'm hopeful that you'll be able to go to sleep tonight feeling somewhat refreshed and slightly less burdened, at minimum with the awareness that we are all in this together and that we can make it through and emerge even a little bit stronger and a little bit wiser about ourselves and the people that we surround ourselves with. My name is Leah Knapp, and as Emma mentioned, I'm a clinical psychologist in Teaneck, New Jersey. Most of my clinical work is with women, like many of you, who are working on their relationships. Some are single, some are newly married, and some are navigating the ups and downs of a longer married life filled with husbands, children, parents, professions, friends, communities, and a variety of their own needs. Over time, more than one time, I've been asked, if I had it my way, what would I suggest that a new couple going into marriage should know in order to lay the foundation for their healthiest marriage possible? And while I know that most of us are not just starting out in our married lives, I believe strongly that reflecting on going back to the basics can be a source of strength, of validation, and maybe even inspiration to us during these times. So what would I suggest in early marriage education include? Well, among many other things, primarily an acceptance of a foundation of uncertainty. For people to understand that they're not expected to be able to manage all aspects of marriage. They don't need to be ashamed. They don't need to feel guilty about bothering their support system, their college teacher, their rub, their mentor, their friend, their community member. That they haven't already failed at marriage before really starting, and that they are going to be okay. That they're already okay. And this is the part that I think is most relevant to us. They're okay because struggling is normal. And they have people who love them and support them, who are here to answer their questions and to lend a supportive ear. Now, every single one of us can identify with the experience of wanting to feel successful, and at times the pain of feeling like a failure. There's a universal fantasy that we should all be able to go through life smoothly and without challenge. And truth be told, we sometimes need that fantasy to keep waking up each morning and face a new day. But it's just that, it's a fantasy. Real life is real life. We struggle, we doubt, we regret, but we also overcome, we believe, and we are proud. The struggle is part of the process, and that's okay. Not because we like it or because it's comfortable, but because it is. It's what's real, and you're not alone. We must learn to be kind. And I don't just mean to your children who are coming in for the 40th time that day to ask for a snack and complain that there's nothing to do. I mean being kind to ourselves. There is so much negative self-talk that comes along with our discomfort with uncertainty. Countless negative voices in the back of our heads. I should really know that. Everyone else seems to be doing fine. I just must not be cut out for this whole wife, mother, daughter, friend, homeschool teacher, working woman, cleaning lady, short order chef thing. There must be something wrong with me that I can't figure out how to make it all work. So I have two words here. Be nice. Just be nice. We would never talk to other people the way we talk to ourselves. And normalizing the universal experience of struggle allows for kinder and more compassionate self-talk, ultimately resulting in a higher likelihood that we'll be able to work through whatever our challenge is at the moment. The next point I want to address here is the experience of the profound loneliness that often accompanies episodes of relationship conflict and adversity, especially a marriage relationship. I've worked with many, many women either during or in the aftermath of painful challenges. And no matter what the specific issue is, a common theme that's reflected by so many is how lonely they feel. And here's the conundrum. There are many aspects of one's marriage and marital relationship that, by all accounts, should stay private. Chazal tell us that Matobu Ol Halecha Yaakov, that in the Midbar, in the desert, the Jews' tents were remarkably positioned so that no one tent faced the door of another tent. That even in the most communally intimate of national circumstances, families were able to preserve their privacy and their dignity. It is not appropriate to discuss everything that happens in our intimate life with other people. And we are encouraged to create and to maintain appropriate personal boundaries. But being too boundaried leads to a profound sense of loneliness and aloneness. So how to balance this? My suggestion here is another two words. Choose wisely. Find your someone, or two someones, or three someones. Find your sisterhood of women you can trust, both their perspective and their confidence. Know with whom you can share what, who to turn to for advice, and who to turn to for support. Sometimes I have this grand dream of introducing people to one another so that each woman who is pained by being the only one going through this can meet someone else who also believes that she is the only one. And when it doesn't feel appropriate to be sharing with peers, or when feelings and behaviors are getting in the way of your ability to function, that's the time to reach out for professional help. And I know it seems like the last thing you want to be doing is adding another time or financial requirement. This investment can really pay dividends multifold. Interestingly, what I've seen over the last couple of months is that, contrary to popular belief, the limitations surrounding the pandemic haven't caused people to experience challenges and struggles that are new to them that they've never faced before. In actuality, what people are facing are the same exact issues that they've always been stuck with, just now more intensified. Couples who had trouble communicating now likely had trouble communicating last year. Couples who struggle with coordinating desire for intimacy probably have either been arguing or avoiding this for a while. What all this together time has done for us, or I prefer to say allowed and encouraged us to do, is to face our struggles head on. Perhaps in the past, a couple could have an argument about something, and then the next day, everyone goes off to their own work and school, comes home at different times, and then at night, leaves back to shul, to a shir, a board meeting, a book club, the grocery store, disappear to the laundry room, anywhere but being in the same place together. And by the third day, no one even remembers what they were fighting about anymore, and so things gravitate back to normal. But in reality, nothing's changed. The underlying issues still remain. When there's nowhere to run and nowhere to hide, the natural tendency to avoid and sweep under the rug is no longer an option. By being forced to stay in close proximity to each other, we've been given a chance to get out of our own way, to bravely decide to learn to relate differently, to communicate differently, to fight differently, and to make up differently. It's a human instinct for most of us to avoid conflict. And most of the time, it's that fear of anger and disconnection that perpetuates our dysfunctional patterns of behavior. What we need to remember is that just as this togetherness forces us to tackle the negativity and conflict head on, it also paves the way for a greater opportunity for repair and reconnection. With nowhere to leave to, we may be more inclined to actually finish a conversation, take it to the end, let the anger process and pass, and allow ourselves to come to a place of understanding, even if not always agreement. Shifting gears somewhat, I want to talk about the guilt surrounding a lack of desire for emotional and physical connection. This too is a very common issue, one that is often under the surface and is definitely intensified during lockdown conditions. Now, to be clear, when we are overwhelmed, stretched thinly, when we have no choice but to put our needs aside, we also end up paying the price. Now, there is certainly a lot to say for individual self-care and for trying to make the marriage a priority. And to the extent that it is possible to do those things, hareze meshubach, the more the better. But there has to be a plan B for when it is literally impossible to put work exhaustion, worry about health, worry about parents, children, laundry, toilets aside to focus on yourself and your relationship. And while we may be able to scrape by and hum along during a more typical circumstance, our current conditions have created a tipping point. And many of our balls that we usually can keep in the air have come crashing down. We generally come last, our marriage second to last, because we've run out of steam and energy and have nothing left to give. But do you know what we have plenty of? Guilt. Guilt that we aren't giving our kids enough of what they need, that we aren't baking or playing or painting or hiking or exercising or cooking or cleaning or providing just the right balance of educational structure and whimsical creativity. Guilt that we should be taking the opportunity to eat better, exercise more. But frankly, after a long, long, long day that now feels the equivalent of a whole week within a 24-hour period, that container of ice cream and watching Netflix are so much more appealing than a pot of quinoa and a walk around the block. Guilt backs us into a corner filled with self-loathing and with resentment. It's hard to yell at your toddler for dumping out an entire container of oatmeal while your back was turned, or yelling at your elderly mother for asking for help getting groceries, but it's a lot easier to lash out at one spouse for requesting some time together. Back to those two magic words, be nice. Yourself may need a good talking to before you move any further. Self says you to you, you've been managing a whole lot. You're a mother, a wife, a teacher, a professional, a doctor, a cleaning lady, an informal entertainer, a chef, a laundromat, a playmate, tech support, personal assistant, therapist, personal shopping, and you are really, really drained. And you feel like everywhere you look is another area you're falling short. But self, you are a rock star. You are doing the best you can with what you have. And you know what, self? You aren't alone. See, there's this great guy who you live with, who loves you and supports you, who at some point you really used to like spending time with, and who's also going through a lot of the same feelings that you are. Maybe the two of you can form some sort of informal support group. When we validate our feelings, remember we aren't alone, minimize the guilt, and approach overwhelming challenges as a team, it just feels less lonely. And you are on the same team. Look, nobody chose to turn their lives upside down in a matter of days with no way to know what the next day, week, or month will bring. Nobody chose to have their toddler and baby underfoot while still trying to maintain some sort of work schedule. Nobody chose to have their college or newly married kids move home from an undetermined length of time, all of whom suddenly forgot how to clean up after themselves or even get along with each other. So if it's not your choice, no guilt. No guilt, no anger. No anger, teamwork. Teamwork. Now spouses can figure out how to help each other get what they need. Or at minimum, we're talking about it instead of just ignoring each other and pretending not to see the elephant in the room. Even if you don't reach an easy solution, the process of approaching the conflict as a team instead of adversaries changes the entire tone of the conversation. And often that's at least half the battle. So while I bet many of you were bracing yourselves for the make time for yourself and prioritize your marriage speech, I'm gonna leave that to other people. See, I'm sure you all know what you're supposed to be doing because we all spend so much time feeling badly that we're not doing those things. I believe that there are times when it is truly impossible. And so you need to make a plan for that too. You need to be honest enough to know the difference between avoidance and reality-based life interference. But minimizing the guilt and reshifting to a team-oriented perspective is a really important first step. So, in sum, be nice. Be at least half as nice to yourself as you are to other people. Well, even when you're not being so nice to them either. Remember, you aren't alone. Try to minimize the guilt by realizing you didn't ask for this. None of us did. But maybe we can still use this time together as an opportunity to have those harder conversations, emerge from this period stronger in our connections and in our convictions, in our love for ourselves, our love for each other, and be in awe of our rock star selves who managed to make it through, even if in more than one piece.
Thank you so much, Dr. Knapp. Next up, we have Jen Streicher from JCC Chicago to discuss topics of parenting and our mental health, specifically, and how we deal with our children during this time.
Is there someone that isn't muted or something? I'm getting a lot of feedback. I don't think it's me, but it might be. Just double check and make sure you're muted. Okay. Hi, I'm Jen Streicher. As Emma said, I am a licensed clinical social worker and I have a master's degree in child development from the Erickson Institute, downtown Chicago. I also have a certificate in infant mental health, which a lot of people ask, well, what is that? It really looks at the parent-child relationship. Since the parent-child relationship is the kind of core of the socialization and development of the child, it really looks at the health of that and considers the parent mental health and well-being as a really strong influence on how a child is going to develop and cope with certain situations. So I was so excited to be invited to ask to speak because, as we all know, this is a really challenging time. I will also say that I am a mom myself. I have two boys in elementary school. My son Elias is 10, and my son Caleb is 7. And they are downstairs, and I have informed them they need to try to be quiet before going to bed. So in my role at the JCC, I provide support and consultation to staff and families at our preschool and day camping sites. I also run support groups for brand new parents, so moms that have recently welcomed babies. And so, yeah, I'm sitting in the same boat as many of you are, as you are, you know, trying to figure out how to handle this whole situation. When I was speaking to Emma and asking her sort of like what is on people's minds, I know for me and maybe for some of you, I'm thinking a lot about, okay, so we've been getting through and surviving the last couple of months, and my kids still have 2 more weeks of school this week and next week. But you know, the finish line is there. Then there's the question of what next. A lot of people don't know whether their camps are running or not. Even if they are going to be running, they don't know if they feel comfortable sending their children. So we're in this kind of state of perpetual uncertainty and unknown right now for both us parents and also for kids. Our schedules and routines are completely different. Everyone's at home in the same space. Our expectations are constantly changing, and we kind of don't know what is okay from day to day and minute to minute, because it seems like our knowledge of this virus is also changing that rapidly. There's incredible amounts of stress as we try to go without our usual support structures of our community, as some people were talking about, whether it's grandparents or babysitters or your childcare center, all of those things. So I don't know about any of you, but I am exhausted from the monotony and sort of the Groundhog Day of all the days bleeding together. And there's just this kind of general loss, this sense of loss of our normalcy and our safety. And that's very real. We need to have the space to grieve that. And I think we've been doing that for the coronavirus piece. And each step where something's gonna be expected, we have to allow ourselves a minute to grieve that as well. Because, you know, it's really an important piece in order to be able to move forward. We have to acknowledge what we've lost. And so, yeah, and just when we're getting somewhere settled, we're about to be uprooted again, right? Because we're starting to realize, okay, summer, oh gosh, what's gonna happen? it's kind of terrifying. So for me, when I think about the words that describe how I'm feeling, I come up with untethered, disorganized, unraveled, very scattered. If anybody feels that way, you can raise your hand or just click the raise your hand button in the little chat area, because I want to know I'm not alone. Dr. Neha Navsaria, psychiatry professor at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, said sitting with uncertainty is one of the most difficult tasks for any human being to do. Learning how to manage it is one of the best skills one can develop to contribute to mental wellness. And this is something I think that both of our two speakers before me were talking about as well. So I'm glad to see we're all on theme. How can we not be in this time, right? We're lacking the boundaries that we usually have. I think somebody was talking about boundaries. You know, we usually have the kind of natural boundaries of going to an office or our kids going to school or they're at their activities and we have a minute to breathe. Now that those boundaries aren't there, it makes sense that we're all sort of feeling like we're melting apart. In which case we have to be even more intentional about creating some sort of structure and boundaries for ourselves and for our kids. Without those boundaries, we just feel out of control. So if we think about our external structures that I just mentioned, providing safety and containment, if you think about a jar, right? And this might be like our work and kids' activities in school, and we can, you know, kind of be inside in this little protected space for a minute. And then, you know, we might have to open it up and come back out and go to another spot. Just as those things help us feel pulled together and at ease, we often think about, in the mental health world, we talk about parents as containers for their children, and specifically when it comes to emotional expression and their emotional experience. I see some people nodding, which is nice. Thank you. So if you think about it, when I was thinking about this, the metaphor is really about, you know, but then inside there's this nice, open, available space that can be safe because we can put a lid on it, right? But it's open and available to hold whatever needs to be held. And we as parents, this is what we're supposed to do for our children. It's easy to think about meeting their physical needs, you know, and their intellectual needs and, you know, helping them with homework, anything of that. But like often the emotional needs can go a little bit under the radar because they're not as easy to see and they're not as easy to identify, because a lot of children, especially if they're young, I actually was curious of, you know, what the age ranges are of children on this call, like, you know, preschool age, elementary school age, high school age, beyond high school. I'm sure we run the gamut, I would guess. Yes? Yeah? Okay. But, you know, especially the younger children and even into teenagers, they can really have a hard time understanding how they're feeling and expressing it in words, which is why we have to really tune in to their behavior for some cues. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, but, you know, every child experiences strong emotions. Lives sometimes seem trivial to us. It's important that we really think about it from their perspective and try to understand that it is a big deal for them. Like, I'll never forget, my son, if he overhears me, will be so embarrassed that I'm saying this, but my older son had his first, like, crush on a girl last year, somebody else, and he was just devastated and crying. And of course, in my mind, I'm like, you're in fourth grade, really? But I couldn't say that, of course. I had to sort of be like, you know, really be there with him in that pain and be patient and help him pass through it. So again, just kind of thinking about it from their underdeveloped perspective, if you will. And, you know, everybody knows when we keep these difficult emotions inside, it can lead to some problems later in life in terms of mental health and well-being. So we as parents can help them release these feelings by creating a container for them. And we do this through our relationship and being, you know, that open space and that safe space. That's one way. And then the other way is by providing a structure, because they can't provide it for themselves. We want our interactions to say to our children, pour your emotion into me. I can handle it, right? I can hold this for you. Well, I feel like I'm asking a lot because we already have so much and we already are dealing with so much, you know, but we want to be that shelter, that shalom bayit that Leah was speaking about, where our kids can rejoice and celebrate, and also where they can wrestle with what's inside. So when we think about resilience, right, the ability to bounce back from adverse circumstances, it really starts with being able to acknowledge those difficult feelings and to cope with them. You have to name it to tame it, as some say. Mr. Rogers said, anything that's human is mentionable, and anything that is mentionable can be more manageable. When we can talk about our feeling, setting, and less scary, the people we trust with that important talk can help us know that we are not alone. So again, it goes back to what Leah was talking about, is finding those people, right? Finding those couple of people that you're going to let into the fold and really share what's going on inside of you, because you need a container for it. You need a place for it. So I'm going to bring my little Russian dolls as a demonstration. So if this is your child, this is you. You are the container, right, for your child. Actually, I should have done one less, one smaller. Sorry, here's the baby. You're the container for that child's emotions, right? But full, where can your child's feelings go? You need to find another place to put it, someone who can hold your stuff so that you can hold theirs. And this is where we get to that sort of self-care piece. And as Leah said, you know, I think we do way too much beating ourselves up about this. There's, we live in a world of social media and of Instagram and of curated ideas of what our lives look like, and also information overload, where you have a million and one experts. You know, I have lots of letters after my name, but I do not claim to be an expert, especially not on you and your family. You know, I think Barbara mentioned, you know, I consider you the experts on your own families and your own children. You know, but we have all these books and resources saying, do this, do that, don't do that. Oh my gosh, don't ever do that. If you do this, you're the worst parent ever. And if you do that, well, oh my goodness, we'll put you up on a pedestal. And so then a lot of that social comparison comes in. So I love, 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 and I'm going to use this, Leia, I love her, be nice. And I'm going to start telling myself that tonight. Especially as I'm going through this and feeling like I'm kind of stumbling. I'm going to say, be nice, Jen. but I'm going to argue for even if it's just 2 minutes, don't let yourself put yourself at the bottom of the list. This is what we do as moms, right? We put ourselves, we hold everybody. We are the container, and the container is only this big, but we're holding 15 times this much. Okay. We need to find a way, even if it's for a moment, to be able to do something for ourselves that feels good. For me, in this crazy time, I've gotten really into gardening in the last couple years. I never thought of myself as a nature person. My moment is in the morning. I take my coffee. I go outside. I take a 2.5 minute walk around my backyard and look at all my plants. And then I come back in, and that's my moment. And it's amazing what even just a brief moment can do in terms of helping me feel prepared to then meet my children where they need me to be. Practicing mindfulness can be really helpful, especially when you're feeling overwhelmed and sort of out of sorts, like remembering just to breathe. We forget that. We forget to breathe. And taking 3 slow, deep breaths where you kind of count to 3 in the inhale, hold for 4, and breathe out for 5. If the exhale is longer than the inhale, it tends to be more calming. You know, being able to do some compression, fist clenching and opening, that can relieve tension. And coming up with a mantra for yourself. If it's not be nice, then maybe your mantra needs to be like, I'm a rock star. Maybe it needs to be, I got this. Maybe it means to be, it is what it is. Whatever works for you, being able to find a nice to speak to yourself. The interesting thing about this is, you know, it really, there's all this talk of self-care, and for some people it's a manicure or a haircut or, you know, any of those things, but it's really personal, and it really has to be about what is rejuvenating for you. I can't stand sitting in a chair and getting my nails painted. Like it is not relaxing for me. So you have to find those things. And I like to use this metaphor of a mosaic. So this is a mosaic that I made when my older son was just born. He was about 6 months old, and I took a mosaics class. Never in my life had I ever cut a piece of glass or done anything like this. And I use this metaphor with my new moms a lot. If you think of yourself as like a solid piece of glass before you have kids, your child is born, your first child's born, and you drop it on the floor and it crashes into a million tiny pieces, right? So who you were before is kind of scattered everywhere. Now, our role when we're a mom is to look at all those shards, pick them up. Do I still need this? Yes. Okay. I'm going to find a place for it. Do I still need this one? No. Okay. I can toss it. Thinking about what were the things, I think we get so lost in this parenting journey that we forget who we were before. And what were the things that felt good to us as people, as women, as students, as professionals, whatever they are. And we get to the frame. This is our identity as mom, and this is always going to be here, no matter what's in there. This is always going to be here, and that's the backdrop under which everything else can be placed in a thoughtful and intentional way. So now that I've talked about you and taking care of you, so you can take care of your kids, let's talk about this summer for a second. No matter what it looks like, our kids are going to have an awesome summer. Now, I don't know about you. I'm less worried about than I am about myself and my sanity. They're going to have an amazing time. They are wired for play and creativity. They are wired to remember the little special moments in a way that we forget. My mom is now deceased, but one of the things I remember most, I was in first grade and I had pneumonia and I was home from school for an entire week and I was miserable and sick and high fevers. And what I remember from that week was that I baked cookies with my mom every day, a different kind of cookie each day. That is all I remember from that time. And I feel like our children at this time are just going to remember, you know, remember that silly chant we made up because we didn't have school and blah, 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 and summer and camp, you know, they're going to make their fun. But they need our help in order. The ways we can help. So providing some structure, right? We all do better when we have an idea what to expect, as we talked about before. I have my phone, I have my watch, I have my planner, I have all those things that help me understand what's coming up for my day. And that's partially why we're feeling so much more off kilter, because what we know and can expect is changing all of the time. So I would encourage you, if you aren't going to send your child to a program, and we'll talk about that in a second too, I encourage you to just try to come up with some sort of schedule for your family. I'm sure you've already done this during e-learning, but think about a very loose kind of schedule where there's blocks of, you know, creative time, activity time, like sports time. Maybe there is some screen time built in, you know, all of those things, but that everybody knows what to expect. And as well, when you are enlisting your partner support, as Leia so adeptly suggested, make sure that you both know, like, who's in charge at that time. I encourage you to really be intentional and block out that time, because otherwise it's sort of leaves so much room for miscommunication. And, you know, oh, if you just end up getting angry with kid duty when, and that's not to say that kids need to be entertained all the time. And we're going to get to boredom in a second. Now, some camps are running with modifications, and maybe that feels like it will work for you. Some aren't, and I know some people who have had babysitters that they've started having come over, or using extended family or grandparents, or setting up some co-op deals with friends. Maybe you're keeping it as a small group, but you're alternating days so you know you have some protected time. You know, but I encourage you to think about those options and just for family. This is another situation where we have, you know, mom shaming, and now we have coronavirus shaming, where people are sort of like, oh, you did this, or you did that, they did that. And what are they thinking? You know, you have to do what's going to work for your family. And then thinking about the emotional piece, right? Like, if they don't get to go to camp. And it's not our job to take away those yucky feelings. It's our job to kind of be with those yucky feelings and to sit with our kids in those yucky feelings and say, this is really yucky. And I'm sad for you and I'm sad with you that you can't go. But if we try to shoo away and make it all okay, that our kids never get the experience of feeling it and knowing that they can survive it. My colleague, Rachel, as soon as we found out that Camp Shy was canceled, she immediately panicked and was thinking about her 12-year-old son and like, oh my gosh, this is his happy place. What am I going to do? He's going to be so devastated. How am I going to tell him? Oh my gosh, I'm going to get online. I'm going to order a water slide and water guns and this and all the other. And like going off the deep end. And she stopped herself and she said, wait, I'm not even giving him a chance to have any feelings about this. You know, and she's a social worker, she's a mental health professional, but we all do this, right? Because it hurts us when our children are hurting. But to be able to sort of stand in the face of that and say, yeah, this is really a bummer. And be with the honor that feeling, because then children learn that those negative feelings don't have to be something to be scared of or run away from, that they actually can help us to move forward creatively. And then, you know, once you've been there, if your child has gotten past that, you know, we're all worried about the onboard, I'm sure, especially if there's no camp, right? Like, how many times are you going to come in and tell me you're bored and you don't know what to do? And I think that goes to sort of our rapid pace of life these days, that we are all so scheduled, and our kids too. It's not something we're good at as adults, open-ended time. I know for me, I'm always like on my phone if I have a minute free, right? Because it's hard to be in that space. The problem is that we think of boredom as lost productivity and a rather unpleasant experience. So we search for something else to engage ourselves. But actually, it's being bored that then gives birth to creativity. I think it is very difficult for us as parents because of that social comparison. What's that person doing? Is my child missing out? Am I not giving them enough opportunities? All of these things. I would go beyond that, though. Underneath that, I think the hardest thing is sitting with our own difficult emotions around it. When our kids are bored, then we feel pressure and we feel like we have to fix it. And then we scramble and then we get frustrated that we have to make a plan. Instead, I really suggest you kind of scaffold it with your kids and sit and think, okay, what things do we like to do? Make a whole big list of things you like to do. If your kids are little, you can draw pictures. And really think about what kinds of things are fun. What would you like to do that you don't normally get to do? And really have them come up with the list and then be able to say, okay, like, how should we do this? In what order should we do this? And kind of have that kind of master list of things on hand throughout the summer that they can be kind of going through and checking off and finding things. And again, it's really about managing our own feelings and our own expectations and really being able to find those little moments of gratitude. Gratitude has been shown to be one of the most influential factors in determining resilience, because if we can find the positives and the growth moments, even if they're moments, micro moments, it can really help bolster us through the harder times. So really, with closing, I would like to just kind of encourage you to think about how you're feeling and really give space to that so that you can really give space to your kids and their feelings. And also just remembering that, like, you are doing an amazing job. If you look at your children and how wonderful they are, just know that that is because of you. And I actually, for me, I'm really interested if there are specific questions. I think, Emma, you had said we were maybe gonna have time for some questions. Sometimes I feel like I'm talking, but maybe what I'm saying isn't relevant or doesn't resonate for you. So I'd love to know what's on everybody's mind and see if we can hash some of that out too. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Jen. Yeah, so now we're going to have time for questions. I'm going to start off with one question that I had. And anyone is welcome to write in the chat either privately to me or to everyone, and I will direct them to the speakers. So just to start off, this is addressing all three speakers, Barbara, Dr. Knapp, and Jen. What is something that you believe that we can learn from this time to positively affect life afterwards? Whoever would like to start can just jump in.
Well, I'm not muted, so I guess I'll go first. I think for me, I think what's going to feel positive to each person is going to be unique, right? Because you're going to notice, you're an individual, you're going to notice different things than I might. For me, just slowing down, I think being able to recognize that we actually are getting a whole lot done, even though it doesn't feel like it. And we don't have to be running like crazy people everywhere all the time. I think is something that maybe we can try to preserve a little bit of that on the other side.
Okay, I guess I'll go next. Like I said, I'm based here in Teaneck, New Jersey land, and I don't know necessarily about the culture of your community, but I know that here we are notoriously famous for early planning. So your bar bat mitzvah is on the school calendar 2 years to the minute that the child's born. You have to put it on the calendar. I remember my son was born on a Wednesday, and there was another child of our community who was born Monday, 2 days before. And when my son was born and the doctor said, Mazel tov, it's a boy, I said, oh God, same parsha as the Schwartzes. Because how are we going to figure that out? Everything has to be done in advance, has to be on the calendar. We do our carpools for the following September by the previous Sukkot. I'm embarrassed, but we do. And I think that the biggest lesson that we never would have ever allowed ourselves to learn is to be able to sit, as Jen said, to sit with that uncertainty. We are now in June. We don't know what camps are opening and what camps aren't opening. We don't know when they're opening. First it was, we're going to tell you May 15th. And then on May 15th, they said, actually, June 1st. On June 1st, they said, well, really June 15th. These are for families who made their carpool for camp before Hanukkah. And now nobody knows what's going to be. So that we'll be able to go to sleep at night and say, you know what? I survived this. There was a time period where my son was very into those I survived books. Now, I'm not saying that I survived the 2020 pandemic is anything like the Titanic or some of the other disasters, but we feel like that sometimes. And so we need to remember we managed to do this. We managed to actually have a child turn 12 or 13, and we didn't have 27 giveaways and a motivator and a party and a this, and we actually liked it better. We liked it better that it was quiet and it was just the people we actually wanted to see that came by our homes and gave us a big smile and came to a car parade. We liked it better that mom could sit next to the kid on the lawn when they read their parsha from the tikkun for their neighbors across the street. So I think what we're going to come out of this more positively is to realize that we found beauty and we found comfort and we found delight in things that we were so petrified of. We needed to make a carpool for September the previous October.
And Barbara, would you like to go next?
Doing things without thinking as much as we always do. Yes, it's the same thing out this way too with bar mitzvahs and weddings and you name it. It's all the same. But we've learned that we don't know what's coming. We really don't. So we have to stay in the moment and deal with what we do know at this time and breathe through it. And again, being kind to ourselves. I think that's one of the best messages both of you said. And that's what I tell my clients, be kind.
This is a question specifically for Jen. In this age of uncertainty, as much as we can try to deal with it on our own, how do you think is an age appropriate way to address kids? Do we give them, I don't know, thresholds that we'll reach this point and then discuss it again? What do you suggest for the uncertainty of the future?
I mean, I guess it depends what they're asking about. I really would always start with, you know, naming the fact that it's so hard not to know. It's so hard. And like, it's hard for me not to know, even though I'm a grown up. Like, this is hard for me. And I really don't know. I wish I could give you an answer, but I can't right now. Yeah, I love that idea of, you know, check in with me again. There are some kids that are going to be incredibly anxious. I have a child like that. And so he will ask and ask and ask and ask. And eventually I need to say, like, I'm going to answer your question one more time. And then I'm not going to answer again. however, yeah, I think it really depends on the age of your child as well and what they're asking about. But I find that many kids with this, because they're at home and they're in their safe space for the most part, I know not every home is a safe space all the time, but because they're with the people that matter most to them, they're less uprooted by the uncertainty out there, in my experience, because that core is still intact. And so as long as you can remain steadfast and really say, like, I know this is really hard, I'm so glad we're in this together and I'm right here with you, and as soon as I know something, I'll be sure to let you know. I think that's the best we can do right now. We always want to have the answers for them, but in this situation, we just can't. Yeah. I don't know if anybody else has anything to add. I'm happy for other people to add to that.
Okay. I think we have one last question just for Dr. Knapp. How do you suggest, sorry, let me read the question. How do you suggest that you make time for your spouse? Like, are there suggestions for quality time to spend together when we feel like we're spending all our time together?
I think it's a very good question. And I think that, you know, that's something that we might have to confront even not during this time. You know, we go through phases in our lives when there's no time to spend together, where we're so centered on our jobs, on our kids, on our shuttling from here to there, that we don't have any time to connect. But then there's that time before, and then there's that time after. And it's important to realize that it's that being purposeful, I think, is really the operative word, where you're not going to say, okay, well, we don't really need to spend time together because, like, we're both retired and we spend, like, all day together all the time. Now, you may be spending all these minutes in the same space as each other, but yes, to be intentionally connective requires purposeful forethought. And so, yes, everybody's spending all of this time together. And I think it's important to sort of break this into two different categories. It's those people who have all the time to spend together and so they have no time to spend together, and people who have no time to spend together and so they have no time to spend together. And for those two, the tactile approaches may be somewhat different. Jen, I had visions of you drinking coffee, walking around your yard for those 2.5 minutes in the morning. And I thought that was fantastic. And I think that's such a good metaphor. Literally 2 minutes, 5 minutes. It's not so much the quantity as it is the quality. And so when you tell yourself, you know what, this is really hard and it's impossible for me to have date night under the current circumstances. Okay, so once you've owned what you can't have, that frees you up to sort of think more creatively about what you can have. You say, you know what? Okay, maybe not, but what if we both got up a half an hour earlier? What if we both got up 15 minutes earlier? What if we both had our coffee intentionally and purposefully in the same room at the same time, where we coordinated that schedule so that we can do that together? And maybe somebody takes a shower before, after, or Donovan before, after. And so we do that on purpose. And it's the mentality of knowing that we're having that time together that is almost more valuable than the time spent itself. And then for those people who have tons of time together, so it's the same idea, you know, that loose schedule. Okay, so from 10 to 12, we're going to have alone time in the same room. And from 12 to 1, we're going to have together time in the same room. And sort of, you know, arrange it so that we are intentional and purposeful about our time together, which we know you can watch TV where, okay, I'm going to take this amount of time, or I'm going to take that time to be on my phone or play a game or call a friend. And it feels rejuvenating and it feels relaxing because you've intentionally chosen to focus on using that time for a purpose. Mm-hmm. Or you could just get lost in it. And then you've had 5 times the amount of time, but you don't feel rejuvenated at all because it didn't mean anything. So intentional and purposeful, either find those few minutes where there's very few minutes, Or find those few minutes when there's so much time that it feels endless, you end up with nothing.
I was just going to add to think about, I think you glitched a minute, Emma, when you were asking the question, but it had to do with the couple, right? Like connecting with your partner. Yeah. So my husband and I just celebrated our anniversary a couple weeks ago, actually. And we usually, you know, get a babysitter and we go out and it's the two of us and it's like our date night, right? It's like, yes, we get away from them for a little bit. We get to be grownups. Obviously we didn't do that this year. So we ordered in a meal, from one of a fancier restaurant, one that we would never actually go to in person because it's way too expensive, but now you can actually get a decent thing. And it was fancy and fun in that it came with all the different components and instructions on how to do the plate, like how to plate it for each thing. So that was like a fun activity for us. But then the greatest part was, and I was sort of like, oh, what is this going to be like? I mean, our kids are going to be around. How are we going to have like a nice date night with our kids around? And our kids decided that they were going to be the entertainment, the tableside entertainment. And then my older son insisted after each course that we plated, he sent us back to the dining room and he came and served them to us. And I ended the night like, well, that was different than what we usually do. But like, it was so sweet because they got to see us in a way that they don't usually get to see us, right? Like as a couple. And they got to participate in that. They've never been with us for our anniversary dinner. And so finding those hidden gems and those hidden blessings in things that you sort of anticipate, you know, oh, this isn't going to be the same. Or, you know, you might go in with one mentality, but if you can leave your mind open just enough to let that blessing in, it can really, it'll be a moment I will not forget. So, yeah, there's that potential. Anything else?
I think that's all the questions we have, but thank you so much to all the speakers. And to thank you to everyone for coming. I know I gained a lot and I'm sure everyone did as well. So again, thank you for coming and have a great night.
Emma, if anybody has specific questions that they want to ask and didn't feel comfortable asking here, you can feel free to give my email address. I'm sure other people would share that sentiment too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take care. Good night, everybody. Stay well.
Good night.